This morning, America's First News starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This morning, with your host, Gordon Deal.
First step for Gorsuch. Good morning, I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka on this Monday, April 3rd. Glad you're with us. Here's what we have for you this hour.
Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch gets a vote today from the Senate Judiciary Committee. He's expected to advance along party lines. The bigger issue will be in the full Senate.
Search and rescue efforts in Colombia after mudslides inundated an area in the southwest part of the country. More than 250 are dead, with many others missing.
In sports, Gonzaga and North Carolina battle tonight for the men's basketball national championship. South Carolina won the women's title last night.
And how airlines are set to fudge baggage handling stats in their favor.
What airlines are going to be able to do is send you notification that your bag didn't make your flight. And this is a great benefit for travelers because you'll know that the bag was lost. You don't have to wait at the carousel until the last bag comes up and you're all nervous and anxious.
Wall Street Journal airline writer Scott McCartney on streamlined luggage systems that could skew stats. He's here in about 20 minutes. Families and rescuers are searching for victims of flooding and landslides in Colombia that have killed more than 250 people. We get more now from this morning's Mike Gavin.
Several rivers burst their banks near the southwestern city of Macoa in the early hours of Saturday, sending water, mud, and debris crashing down streets and into houses as people slept. Even in a country where landslides are a fairly common occurrence, Reuters says the scale of the Macoa disaster was daunting compared to recent tragedies, including a 2015 landslide that killed nearly 100 people. Colombia's deadliest landslide in 1985 killed more than 20,000 people. Gordon.
Thanks, Mike. This weekend's mudslides, by the way, came after deadly flooding in Peru, killed more than 100 people and destroyed infrastructure. To Washington now, the Senate Judiciary Committee will vote today on Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch. It's expected he'll advance to the full Senate. That's where things will get interesting later in the week. Judge Gorsuch needs 60 votes for approval there. Whether or not Democrats filibuster is up to Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, who was on NBC's Meet the Press.
You can do a lot of finger pointing. Each side has some right here. Let's stop this now. And the way to stop it is the way I mentioned. You know, other presidents have consulted the other side.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said Democrats risk making some unusual history.
I think it is noteworthy that Supreme Court justice has ever, in the history of our country, been stopped by a partisan filibuster, ever.
Mr. Gorsuch will need 8 Democratic votes. Right now, he officially has 3. Red State Democrats, Manchin from West Virginia, Heitkamp from North Dakota, and as of yesterday, Donnelly of Indiana. If Mr. Gorsuch can't get the 60 votes, Senate Republicans will have to consider what's called the nuclear option, and that's a strategy invented by Democrats that changes the rules so that nominees only need a simple majority. Well, with the Senate careening toward a showdown over Mr. Gorsuch, the long history of relative collaboration on Supreme Court matters has come to this, a battle this week over a plainly qualified, mild-mannered nominee who had no major stumbles in his hearings. And New York Times congressional correspondent Matt Flegenheimer says each party's justification can often be summarized with a schoolyard classic. They started it. Matt set this up.
Obviously, this is not occurring in a vacuum. It comes on the heels of Republicans refusing to even consider the nomination last year of Merrick Garland, President Obama's nominee, because it was, they said, during an election year, and then they wanted to let the voters have their say at the ballot box in November. Even before that, there was this sort of history of pretty rancorous Supreme Court hearings. There were certainly some lesser-known shifts over these last 15 or so years surrounding lower court judgeships, with filibustering going on both sides under President Bush and President Obama. So we're certainly seeing all of that come to a head here in the Gorsuch nomination.
Boy, you know, even the second paragraph of your story kind of put this in perspective, when you pointed out that Antonin Scalia, 98 votes he earned from the Senate. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, 96. Man, how far we've fallen.
It's really quite something. And there's also, you know, there's this notion that, you know, the Robert Bork nomination in particular in 1987, he was actually rejected by the Senate. And then the Clarence Thomas nomination in 91 are kind of considered these seminal moments in the history of court nominations, and they certainly are. But for the, you know, quarter century that followed that, really up until the Merrick Garland nomination, you saw, you know, increasingly tight margins, and you saw certainly dozens of senators in a lot of cases dissenting, voting against presidential nominees for the court. But you did not see a great deal of talk about the filibuster. Samuel Alito was filibustered unsuccessfully under President Bush. And for the most part, these nominees got through with pretty solid margins in the 60s and the 70s over these last 25 years or so. So we are seeing a real shift, even in these last couple of years. Obviously, Merrick Garland was sort of the precipitating event in recent history.
We're speaking with Matt Flegenheimer, congressional correspondent at the New York Times. He's written a piece called The Roots of the Battle Over Gorsuch. They started it. Sounds like almost a third grade argument. You quoted somebody or made the point in your story that I scribbled down here. This person was saying it may be at some point impossible to confirm any nominee unless the president in charge has his party controlling the Senate. Any nominee it could come down to at this point?
It's really something. I mean, you know, you even heard before the election last year some Republicans saying that if Hillary Clinton won the election, that they would move to keep the seat vacated by Scalia when he died vacant for as long as possible, and really do all they could to keep it an eight-justice court. So I think both sides at this point are very entrenched, particularly on the sort of respective bases, the progressive and conservative bases. And they're all very aware of how impactful the court can be to advance a political agenda. This is not necessarily seen. It was always political to some extent, but I think even more so, you see parties looking at the courts as ways to really either accelerate or solidify, you know, political agenda items of theirs. Yeah. And that seems new, or at least accelerated in recent years. And you see a sort of campaign-style feel, including heavy spending from outside groups, around something like the Gorsuch nomination.
Where did this all start, Matt? Any way to pin it down?
we tried to get at that here. It's a long history. I mean, there was a successful filibuster, a bipartisan basis, actually, in 1968. Lyndon Johnson nominated Abe Fortas to be Chief Justice. He was already on the court. And both parties actually banded together, members of both parties in the Senate, to stop that. It was sort of a lame duck year for Johnson. There were concerns about Fortas's closeness with the Earl Warren court. So there's some precedent here. But what we're seeing now is pretty uncharted territory. There has never been a successful partisan filibuster of a Supreme Court nominee, and we might well see that.
Is this what we demand as voters from our representatives? Because I don't think I'd behave this way in my regular course of life, the way some of these senators are behaving.
I'm sure that's true. I mean, to some extent it is, though, because you see, I think, increasingly in both parties around the primary process, there is, a great emphasis, particularly on the right, on matters of the Supreme Court. I covered Ted Cruz last year during the presidential campaign.
Okay.
And at stop after stop, and he obviously made a point of highlighting this given his own background, but at campaign stop after campaign stop, he talked about the Supreme Court. Voters were animated by the Supreme Court. It really was, I think, especially in the general election, for voters who were perhaps wary of President Trump, an issue where they said, okay, I don't agree with everything, but I think he's going to appoint or nominate justices in the Scalia mold, and I feel more comfortable with that than whatever Hillary Clinton might do.
Thanks, Matt. Matt Flegenheimer, New York Times congressional correspondent. 15 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Reminder, by the way, we can connect on social media. You can friend us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter with the username @ThisMorningShow. If you like a little cynicism and sarcasm, you can follow me directly @GordonDeal. Thanks for being with us on this Monday. Chicago police have arrested a 14-year-old boy in connection with a sexual assault that was streamed live on Facebook. A 15-year-old girl was lured to a Chicago residence 2 weeks ago, according to police, and assaulted by multiple juveniles while people watched online. The boy is facing charges of sexual assault and manufacture and distribution of child pornography. Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson.
They should be ashamed of themselves. They've humiliated themselves, humiliated their families, and now they're going to be held accountable for what they did.
Those tracking crime in major cities say it's increasingly common for violence to be streamed on services like Facebook and Twitter. According to a tally by the Wall Street Journal, people have used Facebook Live to broadcast at least 64 violent or criminal acts, including murder, suicides, and the beating in January of a mentally impaired teenager, also in Chicago. In that case, four young African Americans allegedly tied, beat, and cut a white teenager while shouting racial insults. It's 20 minutes after the hour on This Morning. Jennifer Koshenka is here with more of America's First News.
Florida President Juan Manuel Santos has pledged hundreds of thousands of dollars in aid for Jim's flooded mudslide that left more than 250 people dead. As emergency teams continue to search for survivors in Colombia, the president lauded rescue teams for their tireless work and praised government aid groups for quickly providing food, water, and medicine. The tragedy was triggered by a deluge that dumped 5 inches of rain on the region Friday night.
It's 20 minutes after the hour on This Morning. Jennifer Koshenka is here with more of America's First News.
Florida President Juan Manuel Santos has pledged hundreds of thousands of dollars in aid for victims of a flooded mudslide that left more than 250 people dead. As emergency teams continue to search for survivors in Colombia, the president lauded rescue teams for their tireless work and praised government and aid groups for quickly providing food, water, and medicine. The tragedy was triggered by a deluge that dumped 5 inches of rain on the region Friday night.
We don't know that there's ever been a time in the state of Louisiana where this particular forecast has ever been issued for so much of the state of Louisiana to be at high risk of severe weather.
The governor told residents to charge their cell phones and keep them close by so they can receive urgent weather alerts through the day. The U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Nikki Haley, is calling out Moscow for its actions during the presidential campaign.
Certainly, I think Russia was involved in the election. There's no question about that.
Haley also told ABC News President Trump would fully support strong action against the Kremlin once investigations are complete. She added that there's no contradiction between her tough stance and Trump's repeated public statements seeking to minimize Russia's role. She said Trump has not once told her to stop beating up on Russia. The hit at last night's Country Music Awards, the Backstreet Boys. The boy band brought the audience to its feet in Las Vegas, singing their classic Everybody. Meanwhile, Jason Aldean took home Entertainment of the Year honors.
Man, one of the Eagles just gave me an award. That's probably the coolest thing that's ever happened to me.
Keith Urban, who had success with his Grammy-nominated album Ripcord, was the top nominee with 7, though he walked away empty-handed.
Ouch. Ouch. Thank you, Jen. 22 minutes now after the hour. On This Morning, America's First News. Pleasure with us. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, where helping business grow is pure Michigan. Airlines have found a new way to bend the rules in their favor. Pretty soon, when a carrier loses your luggage, it'll no longer count as lost if you tell them where to send it once it's been located. In the airline's mindset, you agreeing to a bag relocation is not a lost bag. That'll help their performance numbers, by the way, but not necessarily passengers. More from Wall Street Journal airline writer Scott McCartney. Scott, what's up here?
So what airlines are going to be able to do is send you notification that your bag didn't make your flight. And instead of making you go to the baggage office and fill out the necessary paperwork for mishandled baggage, they'll have an electronic link. And so you can respond with the address that you want the bag delivered to, your hotel, your home, wherever it would might be. And this is a great benefit for travelers because you'll know that the bag was lost. You don't have to wait at the carousel until the last bag comes up and you're all nervous and anxious. And you don't have to stand in line at the baggage office. But it's also a great benefit for airlines because it turns out that they only have to report to the Department of Transportation mishandled bag reports filed by passengers. So if the passenger never fills out the paperwork, the bag was never mishandled in DOT statistics.
No.
And it's really going to change how we can compare airlines.
Wow. All right, so that seems to say that airline numbers regarding lost baggage will improve. And
well, yes, because they won't be reporting a lot of the bags that they mishandle. These are important numbers. It's not like, you know, travelers are picking flights based on mishandled bag numbers. They're published monthly by the Department of Transportation, but they do go into, they're used in a lot of different ways. Certainly in airline rankings, we use them in our annual scorecard. Other folks use them in, various things. The Department of Transportation uses them when they look at awarding new routes and things like that. But they look at them in enforcement cases where somebody complains that the airline has really messed them over on baggage, and they start seeing multiple complaints of that, and they can look at the whole and know that, you know, American Airlines has been worse than others, or that Airline X baggage performance has just been getting worse and worse. On the whole, the industry is improving, but I think it calls into question. You basically got some airlines that are reporting apples and some airlines that are reporting oranges, and we're really not going to be able to fairly compare them anymore.
Wow. So it's almost like a riddle. When is lost luggage not lost luggage? And that's when an airline says so.
Yeah.
Basically.
No, they lose the bag and they lose the statistic. It's kind of a very clever dodge of the regulations. And it'll be interesting to see if the Department of Transportation takes action. And, you know, I think they could fix this by rewriting the regulations so that airlines have to report, you know, bags that they mishandled, not just passenger filed reports of bags they mishandled.
Scott, Wall Street Journal airline writer Scott McCartney, who's based in Dallas. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help to become a leader in industries that range from agribusiness and cybersecurity to aerospace and defense. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org, because helping business grow is pure Michigan.
America's First News is online all the time. Follow us on Twitter at This Morning Show, like us on Facebook, or send us an email, thismorning@compassmedianetworks.com.
Thanks for being with us. Good Monday, April 3 to you. Gordon Deal, Jennifer Koshenka here. Some of our top stories and headlines. The Senate Judiciary Committee votes on Neil Gorsuch today. More than 250 dead from mudslides in Colombia. A homeless man who's an admitted crack user is blamed for the fire that collapsed part of a highway in Atlanta. At WrestleMania 33, which some say was the best ever, Lesnar and Orton won. Undertaker, though, could be finished for good. He apparently left his gear in the ring. Gonzaga and North Carolina tonight. And the April the Pregnant Giraffe, a better way for updates, so you don't have to sit there and watch the live stream for hours. That story in about 20 minutes. Well, as the Trump administration begins to shape its policy on drugs, tension is growing between a treatment-focused approach embodied in a new commission on opioids headed by New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and the aggressive prosecution of drug crimes promised by Attorney General Jeff Sessions. It's a story from Wall Street Journal reporter Beth Reinhardt. Beth, what have you found?
So if you had to sort of personify the Trump administration's fledgling drug policy, you could look at New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who was just appointed to lead an opioid commission this week on one hand, and on the other you would have Attorney General Jeff Sessions. So Governor Christie has put the opioid crisis sort of at the center of his governorship. He's been become an evangelist, really, for second chances and, you know, treating the addict as opposed to incarcerating them. And so criminal justice reformers were very encouraged to see him tapped to lead this task force that, you know, will focus on, you know, treatment and prevention of addicts. On the other hand, you have a very tough-on-crime Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, who has vowed to increase prosecution of drug crimes and has even hinted about going after marijuana sales more in states where it's been legalized. And so you know, people look at him, reformers look at him and are wary of a, you know, reprise of the war on drugs. So there's sort of two conflicting messages coming from the administration on drug policy.
Wow. All right, well, Chris Christie was a U.S. attorney for New Jersey at one point. Is he maybe aware of how to strike a balance somehow?
Well, sure. And he's no soft on crime kind of guy either. But he has, you know, tried to make rehabilitation much more available in New Jersey. And this was a big issue when he was running for president in New Hampshire, which is where he really staked his presidential campaign. The opioid crisis has really gotten bad there. And so he talked about it quite a bit, as did Donald Trump and, you know, most of the candidates who were stumping in New Hampshire last year.
You know, just looking at some of the phraseology that each man has used in your story, right? Chris Christie saying it's a disease that can be treated, and talking about addiction. And then he got Mr. Sessions promising to be, or cops promising to be ruthless, and Mr. Sessions planning, pledging to hammer drug
right.
dealers. What could happen here?
Well, the one thing that is noteworthy is, you know, the opioid epidemic is largely a white, rural, working class problem. And, of course, those are the communities that heavily favored Donald Trump. And so you see a much more compassionate tone coming from the administration on that front. And then on the other hand, you have, you know, the drug trade, drug wars, which Trump has frequently associated with illegal immigration and big cities, more of a minority problem, I think, in his eyes. He's described, you know, black and Hispanic neighborhoods as being these very dangerous places. And, you know, when he's talking about those neighborhoods, he's sort of using that law and order, tough on crime language that is different than the much more sympathetic tone you hear on the opioid.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal staff writer Beth Reinhardt. Her piece is called Trump's Drug Policy Takes Shape with Split Personality. You say in the story, critics of the administration say it can't be serious about treating drug addiction while trying to wipe out the Affordable Care Act. How are those two connected?
Right. So Obamacare provided access to treatment for estimated millions of addicts, including hundreds of thousands of folks addicted to opioids. And so some drug policy experts say, you know, how can you say you care about addiction when you're trying to wipe out this health care law that without it, a lot of addicts would not have insurance coverage for treatment?
Thanks, Beth. Wall Street Journal reporter Beth Reinhardt. It's 20 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Thanks for being with us on this Monday. Beyond the headlines now, this morning's Mike Gavin is here with a look at some of the other stories you'll be talking about this morning.
Good morning. Well, a Massachusetts man couldn't believe it was not butter on his bagel, and he won a settlement because of it. Jan Polanek sued two companies that together own more than 20 Dunkin' Donuts franchises after he asked for real butter on his bagel but was given a butter substitute instead. The man's lawyer acknowledged that his client's complaint was a minor thing, but they decided to sue, quote, to stop the practice of representing one thing and selling a different thing. Notice he didn't mention money at all in that statement, and we don't know how much the settlement was for yet because it hasn't yet been filed with the court. An attorney for one franchisee confirms that the case has been settled and the stores have changed their butter serving protocol.
Is that right?
Yes. And I bring this up because this seems to be a thing lately. I was in a Wendy's a couple of weeks ago, and when as I ordered, a man came up to the counter and was irate over the fact that he was given something that was called butter and actually said butter on the packet.
Yeah.
But he said, this is not butter. This is, you know, 10% butter and, you know, 90% trans fats or something.
Oh,
he was very, very particular about the butter. So this might not be an isolated case.
Yeah, this is what I call hashtag first world problems.
yes, all of these problems.
So this guy, he didn't get butter. So we got a lawyer?
Yeah, apparently, yes. Because
I mean, what are we doing here? What happens to, like, if that was me and I was that upset?
Yeah.
I'd negotiate, you know, coffee for life?
Right.
Or donut for life?
I mean, it sounds like he's going to get some money out of this, so he's going to be able to, you know, buy all the coffee and donuts he wants.
Here's what I think. To eliminate the question of whether it's butter or not butter,
yes,
get sausage, egg, and cheese on that bagel instead.
Right.
Takes care of all of it.
Eliminate the problem.
And even if they put butter on it, you won't be able to taste the difference because the sausage is so good.
I would agree.
See? Problem solved.
Solving problems
get
left
rid of
and right.
I mean, get rid of the lawyer. Do we really need a lawyer over butter on a bagel?
I guess. At this point in 2017, there's nothing we don't need our lawyers for.
Not the world I live in, Mike. Sorry, can't relate.
And do you need some election interference? Well, the Russian Foreign Ministry is ready to help, or so it said so on April Fool's Day. On Saturday, the ministry posted on its Facebook page an audio file of the purported new automated telephone switchboard message for Russian embassies. The message said, quote, "To arrange a call from a Russian diplomat to your political opponent, press 1. Press 2 to use the services of Russian hackers. And 3 to request election interference."
Oh, man.
A ministry duty officer confirmed to the Associated Press that the post was indeed an official joke.
How about the Russian Foreign Ministry with a funny?
There are so many things about this that I'm amazed. That, first of all, that they have a Facebook page to begin with.
Okay.
That's number one.
Yes.
And number two, yes, that they would actually try and make fun of themselves in this way, considering this is still an ongoing thing,
right?
And it's kind of a serious situation,
right?
Here. This is pretty amazing.
Wow.
And that somebody was actually willing to admit it as well to the Associated Press. Did not give his name, of course, right. But actually admitted this to the Associated Press.
I like how you did it in your American accent, by the way.
What's that?
The Russian Foreign Ministry message on the machine.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I didn't go as far as to mimic the accent.
To arraigned Russian diplomat.
That's for you to do.
13 minutes now in front of the hour. The powerful performance and incredible battery life of new Dell PCs with Intel Core processors empower small business employees to do their best work wherever work takes them. Dell's U.S.-based small business advisors and price match guarantee mean you'll always get the best deal on the right solution tailored to your business needs. Powerful PCs are just the beginning of a great partnership. Call 877-BUY-DELL now to contact a Dell Small Business Advisor today. That's 877-BUY-DELL. It's 8 minutes now in front of the hour. On This Morning, Jennifer Koshenka is back with more of America's First News.
Court in the Senate is barreling toward a showdown that could have far-reaching implications for the nation's highest court. The high-stakes political battle waging around Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch could lead to a major change in Senate rules. Democrat Chuck Schumer says the GOP did not play fair last year with President Obama's nominee.
Our nominee was Merrick Garland. Mitch McConnell broke 230 years of precedent and didn't call him up for a vote. It wasn't in the middle of an election campaign. It was March.
Only 3 Democrats have said they support Gorsuch, meaning his nomination would fall short of 60 votes, Republican Mitch McConnell.
The business of filibustering judges is a fairly recent invention, ironically, of the now minority in the Senate. The Democrats.
The Senate Judiciary Committee will vote Gorsuch's nomination out of committee today, likely along party lines. After their loss on health care, Republicans in Congress could use a quick victory on a big issue, but it won't be an overhaul of the tax code. Congressional Republicans are divided on significant issues, especially a new tax on imports embraced by House Speaker Paul Ryan. And the White House is sending contradicting signals on the new tax, adding to the uncertainty. Authorities have issued an arrest warrant for a teenage boy in the sexual assault of a 15-year-old Chicago girl that was streamed live on Facebook, and they expect to charge others. Police Commander Brendan Danahan says a 14-year-old has been arrested.
That individual has now been charged. There's a second juvenile warrant that is out there, and we expect that individual to be arrested soon. And then additionally, we still have several other offenders that we need to specifically identify and arrest as well.
Danahan says multiple videos of the attack were made, not just the version that was streamed live. About 40 people viewed the attack live, and none of them reported it to police. For the first time in nearly a quarter century, the Yankees aren't among baseball's top 2 payrolls. The Dodgers topped the major leagues for the 4th straight opening day, but dropped to $225 million, their lowest payroll since 2013. Detroit is second at $199 million. The Yankees are third at $195 million. And the $4.5 million average salary for major leaguers on opening day is up 1.6% from last year.
Say $4.5 million average?
Correct.
Salary?
Correct.
This is the minimum these days. Like, it's like half a million, right?
Or
a million? Oh, my goodness. This is mind-boggling. Thank you, Jen. It's 6 minutes now in front of the hour. On This Morning, America's First News. Thanks for being with us. Still no news from April the giraffe, who has still not given birth, as you may know from watching the live stream from Animal Adventure Park in Harpersville, New York. On Saturday morning, the live feed, though, went offline briefly because of an internet outage causing some angst among viewers and park officials. Later that day, the Facebook post there read, "Our big girl is comfortable, continues to keep her composure better than the rest of us." On Sunday morning, some 150,000 people watched the live feed when she stared at her stablemate. The Morning Post yesterday was, "This morning, keepers report increased discharge, continued lack of interest in food, and full udders. April also continues to be a bit out of character. We continue to watch and wait." Park staff, by the way, debuted a text alert system yesterday so people won't have to be glued to their computers awaiting major developments. That's because April could deliver in an hour or less once in full labor. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Morning, America's First News.